Okay, this is 23rd May 1985 at NRAO in Charlottesville, and talking with Hane Havadam. Well, can you tell me, first of all, what your training was, and then when you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I got to Gothenburg, Sweden in 1948, and started studying at Chalmers for electrical engineering. And I was at the same time an assistant, Professor Rudbeck's assistant. That's how I started, actually. So I was not the kind of student who went through the school in a normal way. He arranged for me to take this course and that course and so forth. The whole thing was sort of a random approach to studies, I think. And I got my master's degree in 53. Yeah, I think it was in 53. This is so long time ago, you know. I feel like I belong in the Smithsonian when you ask these questions. And then I continued there and got my PhD in 57. Mm-hmm. At that point, I moved here as a postdoc, starting in Green Bank, and I've been here ever since.
Right. Well, we'll come back to the Green Bank part, but when did you first learn about or come in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, that was through Rudbeck, of course. He was interested in that, and we had a little station just outside Gothenburg, a small little cabin there where he did all kinds of experiments with the ionosphere.
Right.
He had field strength meters, you know, and these graph recorders that you don't see anymore, and so forth. And I got involved in that, keeping that station running for him and so forth. And then...
Was this what became Onsala?
No, yeah, this was much closer to it. It became Onsala in a sense, but it wasn't the same place.
I see, okay.
Yeah. Right. And then he got interest in radio echoes from meteors, trails. And that came about his friendship with Bernard Lovell and Hanbury Brown and those characters from Judge Bank. And he wanted me to build a radar at 33 megahertz for those kind of investigations.
Now, what stage are we talking about now? Your master's?
As a matter of fact, that became my master's thesis in the end. This must have been in 1949-50, thereabout, that we did this first meteor.
So this was still while you were an undergraduate?
Oh, yes. As I said, I was working for him part-time.
Right.
Now, you have to realize that when he calls half-time is 12 hours a day.
Yeah, right.
So it wasn't that easy to study at the same time, but it worked. And I built that thing, which was more or less a copy, a modified copy of an ionospheric sounder he had done a year or two before. Mm-hmm. So, and I put it up, not in out in this first station, because at the same time, and this must have been around 1950, he got this area out in Onsala. It was a donation. Mm-hmm. And we went out there and we started digging ditches, you know, how things of that sort start. And we installed that thing there, the transmitter, in a bus in an adjacent area, about 4 or 5 miles away. So we didn't have any interference with the receiver from the ground wave. And we put the receiver in a little house out there. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, when they built that house out there in 1950, I think it was, my wife and I lived out there.
I see.
That winter. And we didn't have a road.
Oh, boy.
Or anything like that. We carried all stuff. It was sort of pioneering, but fun.
Yeah.
And that was the first thing, and we then... recorded meteors every night. We were not allowed to run the transmitter. It was high power, 100 kilowatts. We couldn't run it during the daytime because it interfered with the local radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rudbeck wasn't the kind of guy who paid too much attention to the authorities, you know, but
in this case, he was
careful, yeah. And then we automated the whole thing a little bit. I remember we made, I think, one of the first shift registers in the world that way, using 6SN7 tubes, and we just shifted the echoes up time-wise, you know, so you could get a counter that counted how many echoes between 100 and 105 kilometers, how many, and so forth, you know, to make statistics out of that. Now, nothing scientific came out of that.
Before. This is what I was thinking. I don't remember any publications.
No, nothing came out of that. Before Bert Landers Lindblad, who was one of these Lindblads, you know, that there are several of in astronomy. He got interested in that, and he wanted to correlate optical sightings of meteors with this. So we set up a system out in Onsala where he had a bunch of students, I think it was, and they were lying there in chairs, you know, and they had a button.
Right.
And I had the, I put in on the scope, you know, a little dot when that kink got on the film.
Right.
Whenever they pressed the button. And what they did then, they pressed this button, you know, and they put on a chart where that was, and he correlated that with the echo, and he published some.
Right, this is B.L. Lindblad,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Bert, B.A.
B.A. Lindblad,
right. Bert Anders Lindblad. He is a cousin, I think, of
Per-Olof
Lindblad. I think, and so, because I think it was Big Bertel, as we call him, the old Bertel. I think it was his brother.
I see.
Was, but I'm not sure about that.
But what was the antenna that you were using?
Well, the transmit antenna was just a quarter wave, a half wave dipole, a quarter wave above ground. And the receiving antenna was the same most of the time, but in certain experiments where he wanted to concentrate a certain part of the sky, we used one of these Wurzburg antennas we had, and we mounted four Yagis on it.
Have seen that in Onsala.
We used that only as a support for those four Yagis.
Right.
Yeah. So we put that up there.
And the Wurzburg came from where?
It came from Norway. The Germans had put up a whole bunch of them along the Norwegian coast and all the way down into France, actually.
Right.
And we went up there.
Wurzburgs were never used for passive radio astronomy.
Oh, yes, they were.
No, at Onsala.
Oh, yes.
They were, okay.
Oh, yes.
I'd like to hear about that.
Yeah, no, we picked up four of them, I think, in Norway and various stations. And and I went up there with the crew, about the machine shop, you know, we sent up there with little screwdrivers to take that apart.
Right.
It was a fantastic time. But anyway, we got this whole thing shipped to Sweden and put them together. We could salvage only three of the reflectors. So we put up one the way that the one we just talked about, on a vertical axis. And then we took two of them and put them on a polar axis. We just tilted the whole thing like they had done in Boulder. I think that was done in Boulder
right. The
year before or something like that. So we just copied that.
These are all the giant Wurzburg.
Yeah, that's right. Seven and a half meters. Right. Yeah, that's right. And we put up that one you talked about with the radar. It was just put someplace. The others were put in an east-west baseline for an interferometer type arrangement.
Now, what time are we talking about now?
We're talking about 50-51, I think.
That early?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the first things we did in Onsala. So if we can find out when the Onsala Observatory actually became serious.
Right.
There was a whole bunch of things going on there because he wanted it to be protected from interference, you know. So he had that going on for us. It didn't become official right away, although we started, you know how it goes. We started digging there and so forth.
So what was the purpose of the east-west interferometer?
That was for solar work. And we made receivers for 10 centimeters and 21 centimeters. Now that's all we had on the Wurzburgs, I think.
This publication codes 200.
Yeah, that was
for the eclipse, anyway.
Yeah, right. The fourth Wurzburg, or was it five? No, that wasn't the Wurzburg. This is so long ago, I can't remember this. We built two antenna mattresses, we call them, they're for 450 megahertz.
Right.
And I don't remember how large they were now, but they were just, I think it was four antennas horizontal.
Four by four?
No, much more than four the other way. And they were rectangular things.
I see, four by
and,
ten.
And they could tilt in elevation.
I see.
But if I remember correctly, they were transit instruments, yeah. But they were also built, put up as an interferometer. And that's where that frequency
to look at the sun once a day.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, once a day it lasted some time. It was a lot. The beam width in the in that direction was quite wide, actually.
And that was 2 meters.
That was 2 meters. Yeah.
So, once again, I'm not familiar with any scientific publications that came out in solar work in the early 50s from Rydbeck's group. So it sounds like you had a lot of equipment there. And
I think that the Rydbeck's group in those days could be characterized as being engineers, and only engineers. We were interested in building the stuff, making good low noise receivers, making it work, pretty pictures, and so forth. but nothing was ever published. Mm-hmm. And there were several reasons for it, I think. I was not the publishing kind, and the other people who worked, my colleagues, were not either. They were engineers, you know, they wanted to do work.
Well, Rudbeck was a leader and was that way apparently also.
That's right, he was that way too. He was, in some respects, I think he was afraid of publishing certain things. He wanted to be sure first, so he was a little nervous about it. But he wanted to get into the hydrogen line, I remember that. Mm-hmm. And that was the one job we had, was to build a receiver for that. And I went down to Holland to see Müller.
All right, what time is this now?
About...
It was discovered in March 51.
Yeah, that was about the next following year, must have been 52. Mm-hmm. Because I visited Müller when they still were in Kotwijk, yes. I think it was called. Yeah, and the whole thing was on the original German radar antenna there.
Right.
And they had just had, when I got there, they had just had a fire, I think, or there had been a fire.
That was associated with the discovery.
That's right. So, and I think Müller felt that that fire prevented them from being the first.
That's so, another whole thing.
Yeah, right.
I can tell you about that later. Okay.
Yeah, so Doc Ewan and the company got there first. And I learned a lot from Müller there. I spent a couple of days with him, actually. And I also went, I remember, to... Philips in Eindhoven, and I met Charles Seeger, who was there at the time.
That's right.
And he had just developed some low noise. I mean, you laugh at it today, but it was low noise at that time. Tube preamplifier for, I think that was in the 150, 200 megahertz range somewhere, using some lighthouse type tubes that he had developed.
Right.
An arrangement there that we tried to copy, and we succeeded in making a pretty good receiver out. That, and then when I got home again, we built, and I don't remember how long time it took, but maybe a year, year and a half, and we had the simple sweeping type scanning, you know, line receiver, and we got the line.
Mm-hmm. So that would be 53 or something.
Yeah,
perhaps.
something like that. Yeah.
But I gather that you weren't going to scientific conferences either. You're just reading about these things
in the
journals.
Our main contact with the outside world was through visits from the outside. Rudbeck was a very well-known person, and I can remember particularly when Christiansen and Pawsey and Westfold, I think his name was, came on a visit. That was very, very productive for us and useful. And I remember that Christiansen and I became very good friends. We sort of clicked, if you see what I mean, and we corresponded later and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was stimulus from the outside that we got. We were also visited by Bernard Lovell and Hanbury Brown once. They came over and wanted to see what we had done in the meteor radar thing because we had been technical types, you know. We had better equipment than they had at that time anyway. It's just that we didn't do much with it.
Right. Rudbeck, what do you think was his the main reason he was known for? It was ionosphere.
Ionosphere. Oh yes. Yeah.
What more exactly? Can you remind me?
I think that it was the something about the virtual height. He did. He developed something theory of the reflection.
That's what I thought. It was theory, actually. Not
it was theory. Oh no, he was a theoretician. Oh, and there's no question about it. Yes. But that's how he became known. I think.
But he was the head of a giant electronics lab.
That's well, it isn't only a lab as such, but you know, his job at Chalmers was to train engineers. So he had to have this. You know, he had to be the engineering type, so
right.
to speak.
So you mean that there were some theoretical engineering kind of things going on,
as well as practical. He had, in his lab, radio astronomy started out at a very small part. It was me as a graduate or undergraduate student. And maybe a technician who fooled around with it. But the main lab was developing traveling wave tubes at the time, you know, and things of that sort. Vacuum tube stuff, that was the main thrust at the time in that lab.
Okay. Well, let's go back. So you got a successful 21-centimeter hydrogen line receiver.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you do any observations with that?
I did not. I did not do anything. And we just... In a way, I'm sorry to say that during that period, we just improved the baselines and things like that and published. I think we published some pictures, but there was nothing discovered.
Hmm.
at all during the time I was there. I think later things happened, yeah. But during the time I was there, nothing.
So you sort of moved from one project to the next.
That's right.
As the equipment was working nicely.
That's right. So then came 1954, where we had this eclipse mm-hmm. that was total over that observatory, and it was one of the longer ones, if I remember correctly. I think it lasted for 2 minutes.
The totality actually passed over Onsala.
Very close. I think we were just at the edge of the totality. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Rydbeck decided that I should, as my PhD thesis now, do the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So what I did was not alone, there were other people helping there, but I built the receiver for 10 centimeter continuum, for 21 centimeter continuum, and one for 150 megahertz for these mattresses we had. And also I oversaw the building of a scanning ionospheric recorder. You know,
so you see the effect on the ionosphere at the same time. Yeah.
And we also put together a couple of shortwave receiving systems just to measure the field strength from some shortwave transmitters in, I think, in northern Germany or whatever, mm-hmm. so you can see what happened. So, and we worked, and of course there was a deadline on this. And by gosh, even the day before, things didn't work the way they should. But then Emil Blum, whom I had known from very early in the game, from 1951, I think, came up with a group, and I do not remember the names of those.
Well, I can check the publications.
One was a priest, I think.
That would be Simon, maybe?
Simon, yeah, that's right. And they had some receivers with them, and they borrowed that antenna that we had the radar stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they also borrowed one of the mattresses, but I'm not clear on that. And so we did the whole thing together.
Mm-hmm.
And for some peculiar reason, his equipment worked before the eclipse and ours didn't. And during the eclipse, ours worked and his didn't too well anyway. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of a strange thing that happened.
And so you wrote that up in 1959, it appears.
As
your thesis, or is that correct?
No, my thesis was before then, but it wasn't published right away. I mean, I wrote it up, you know. Because I got my PhD in 57.
I see, yeah. Okay. So there's a Chalmers report in 59.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it sort of drifted around, I think, for a while. And you see, I wasn't interested in that publication thing, being an engineer. I just wanted to move to the next project and build something. But what we did, I had to do some science, quote-unquote. Equipment wasn't enough. So we looked at all the eclipse curves.
Right.
And it turned out that the sun was quiet, very quiet, I think it was unusually quiet. Yeah, it was unusually quiet at the time, too. And, of course, at that time, resolution was the thing you were after in solar eclipse. And since there were no bright spots that were cut by the moon's edge, there was nothing to get out of it, you see. And the distribution, brightness distribution on the sun, as deduced from the eclipse curve, is very loose coupling in a way. You can have all kinds of models that satisfy that curve mm-hmm. with a good accuracy. But then we got I could never make it as good as we thought it should be. So then we got this idea that we instead of having